26. The astronomer had interposed himself between the light and the pair in the corner. Sheeran squinted up at him uneasily.
Hello, Binet.
Mind if I join you? He asked. My reckonings are set, and there's nothing for me to do till totality. Binet paused and eyed the apostle, who was poring intently through a small leather-bound book that he had drawn from the sleeve of his robe.
Say, weren't we going to put him away?
We decided not to, Theramon said. Do you know where Sapphira is, Binet? I saw her a little while ago, but she doesn't seem to be here now.
Upstairs in the dome. She wanted to get a view through the big telescope.
Not that there's anything much to see that we can't see with our naked eyes. What about Kalgash, too? Theramon asked.
What's there to see? Darkness in darkness?
We can see the effect of its presence as it moves in front of Dovim.
Kalgash 2 itself, though, it's just a chunk of night against the night sky.
Night, Sheeran mused. What a strange word that is.
Not anymore, said Theramon. So you don't actually see the wandering satellite at all, even with the big telescope?
Binet looked abashed.
Our telescopes really aren't very good, you know. They do fine for solar observations, but let it get just a little dark and...
He shook his head. His shoulders were thrown back, and he seemed to be working hard to pull air into his lungs.
But Kalgash 2 is real, all right. The strange zone of darkness that's passing between us and Dovim, that's Kalgash 2, Sheeran said.
Have you been having trouble breathing, Binet?
A little, he sniffled.
A cold, I guess.
A touch of claustrophobia, more likely.
You think?
I'm pretty sure. Anything else feel strange?
Well, Binet said, I get the impression that my eyes are going back on me. Things seem to blur and, well, nothing is as clear as it ought to be. And I'm cold, too.
Oh, that's no illusion. It's cold, all right, Theramon said, grimacing. My toes feel as if I've been shipping them cross-country in a refrigerator car.
What we need right now, Sheeran said intensely, is to distract ourselves from the effects we're feeling. Keep our minds busy, that's the thing. I was telling you a moment ago, Theramon, why Faro's experiments with the holes in the roof came to nothing.
You were just beginning, Theramon replied, playing along.
He huddled down, encircling a knee with both arms and nuzzling his chin against it. What I ought to do, he thought, is excuse myself and go upstairs to find Sapphira, now that the time before totality is running out. But he found himself curiously passive, unwilling to move. Or, he wondered, am I just afraid to face her?
Sheeran said,
What I was about to propose was that they were misled by taking the Book of Revelations literally. There probably wasn't any sense in attaching any physical significance to the concept of stars. It might be, you know, that in the presence of total and sustained darkness, the mind finds it absolutely necessary to create light. This illusion of light might be all that the stars really are.
In other words, Theramon said, starting to get caught up in it now, you mean the stars are the results of the madness and not one of the causes? Then what good will the photographs that the astronomers are taking this evening be?
To prove that the stars are an illusion, maybe, or to prove the opposite for all I know. Then again,
Binet had drawn his chair closer, and there was an expression of sudden enthusiasm on his face.
As long as you're on the subject of stars, he began, I've been thinking about them myself, and I've come up with a really interesting notion. Of course, it's just wild speculation, and I'm not trying to put it forth in any serious way, but it's worth thinking about. Do you want to hear it?
Why not?
Sheeran said, leaning back. Binet looked a little reluctant. He smiled shyly and said,
Well then, supposing there were other suns in the universe.
Theramon repressed a laugh. You said this was really wild, but I didn't imagine.
No, it isn't as crazy as that. I don't mean other suns right close at hand that we somehow mysteriously aren't able to see. I'm talking about suns that are so far away that their light isn't bright enough for us to make them out. If they were nearby, they'd be as bright as Onos, maybe, or Tano and Setha, but as it is, the light they give off seems to us like nothing more than a little point of illumination, and it's drowned out by the constant glare from our six suns.
Sheeran said,
But what about the law of universal gravitation? Aren't you overlooking that? If these other suns are there, wouldn't they be disturbing our world's orbit the way Kalgash 2 does? And why, then, haven't you observed it?
A good point, said Binet. But these suns, let's say, are really far off, maybe as much as 4 light-years away, or even more.
How many years is a light-year? Theramon asked.
Not how many. how far. A light year is a measure of distance. The distance light travels in a year, which is an immense number of miles because light is so fast. We've measured it at something like 185,000 miles an hour. And my suspicion is that isn't a really precise figure, and that if we had better instruments, we'd find out that the speed of light is even a little faster than that. But even figuring at 185,000 miles an hour, we can calculate that Onos is about 10 light minutes from here, and Tano and Setha about 11 times as far as that, and so on. So, a sun that's a few light years away, well, that would be really distant. We'd never be able to detect any perturbations they might be causing in Kalgash's orbit because they'd be so minor. All right, let's say that there are a lot of suns out there, everywhere around us in the heavens, at a distance of 4 to 8 light years. Say, a dozen or two such suns, maybe.
Theremin whistled. What an idea for a great weekend supplement piece. 2 dozen suns in a universe 8 light years across. Gods, that would shrink our universe into insignificance. Imagine it. Kalgash and its suns, just a little trivial suburb of the real universe. And here we've been thinking that we're the whole thing. Just us and our 6 suns all alone in the cosmos.
It's only a wild notion, said Binet with a grin. But you can see where I'm heading, I hope. During eclipse, these dozen suns would suddenly become visible because for a little while there'd be no real sunlight to drown them out. Since they're so far off, they'd appear small, like so many little marbles. But there you'd have it, the stars, the suddenly emerging points of light that the apostles have been promising us.
The apostles talk of countless numbers of stars, Sheeran said. That doesn't seem like a dozen or two to me. More like a few million, wouldn't you think?
Oh, poetic exaggeration, said Binet. There just isn't room enough in the universe for a million suns, not even if they were jammed right up against each other so that they touched.
Besides, Theremin offered, once we get up to a dozen or two, can we really grasp distinctions of numbers? 2 dozen stars would seem like a countless number, I bet, especially if there happens to be an eclipse going on and everybody's wacky already from staring at darkness. You know, there are tribes in the backwoods that have only 3 numbers in their language. 1, 2, many. We're a little more sophisticated than that, maybe. So, for us, 1 to 2 dozen are comprehensible. And then it just feels like countless to us.
He shivered with excitement.
1 dozen suns. Suddenly. Imagine it.
Binet said, there's more. Another cute little notion. Have you ever thought what a simple problem gravitation would be if only you had a sufficiently simple system? Supposing you had a universe in which there was a planet with only 1 sun. The planet would travel in a perfect ellipse, and the exact nature of the gravitational force would be so evident it could be accepted as an axiom. Astronomers on such a world would start off with gravity probably before they even invent the telescope. Naked eye observation would be enough to let them figure things out.
Sheeran looked doubtful.
But would such a system be dynamically stable? He asked.
Sure, they call it the one-in-one case. It's been worked out mathematically, but it's the philosophical implications that interest me.
It's nice to think about, admitted Sheeran, as a pretty abstraction, like a perfect guess or absolute zero.
Of course, continued Binet, there's the catch that life would be impossible on such a planet. It wouldn't get enough heat and light, and if it rotated, there would be total darkness half of each day. That was the planet you once asked me to imagine, remember, Sheeran? Where the native inhabitants would be fully adapted to alternating daylight and night. But I've been thinking about that. There wouldn't be any native inhabitants. You couldn't expect life, which is fundamentally dependent upon light, to develop under such extreme conditions of light deprivation. Half of every axial rotation spent in darkness. No, nothing could exist under conditions like that. But to continue, just speaking hypothetically, the one-in-one system would...
Wait a minute, Sheeran said. That's pretty glib of you, saying life wouldn't have developed there. How do you know? What's so fundamentally impossible about life evolving in a place that has darkness half the time?
I told you, Sheeran, life is fundamentally dependent on light, and therefore in a world where
life here is fundamentally dependent on light. But what does that have to do with the planet that...
It stands to reason, Sheeran.
It stands to circular reason, Sheeran retorted. You define life as such and such a kind of phenomenon that occurs on Kalgash, and then you try to claim that on a world that's totally unlike Kalgash, life would be...
Theramin burst suddenly into harsh gusts of laughter. Shirin and Binet looked at him indignantly.
What's so funny?
Binet demanded. You are, the two of you, an astronomer and a psychologist having a furious argument about biology. This must be the celebrated interdisciplinary dialogue that I've heard so much about, the great intellectual ferment for which this university is famous. The newspaper man stood up. He was growing restless anyway, and Binet's long disquisition on abstract matters was making him even edgier. Excuse me, will you? I need to stretch my legs.
Totality's almost here, Binet pointed out. You may not want to be off by yourself when that happens.
The newspaper man stood up. He was growing restless anyway, and Binet's long disquisition on abstract matters was making him even edgier. Excuse me, will you? I need to stretch my legs. Totality's almost here, Binet pointed out. You may not want to be off by yourself when that happens. Just a little stroll, and then I'll be back, said Theramin. Before he had taken five steps, Binet and Shirin had resumed their argument. Theramin smiled. It was a way of easing the tension, he told himself. Everybody was under tremendous pressure. After all, each tick of the clock was bringing the world closer to full darkness. Closer to the stars? To madness? To the time of the heavenly flames? Theramin shrugged. He had gone through 100 gyrations of mood in the past few hours, but now he felt oddly calm, almost fatalistic. He had always believed that he was the master of his own destiny, that he was able to shape the course of his life. That was how he had succeeded in getting himself into places where other newspaper men hadn't remotely had a chance. But now everything was beyond his control, and he knew it. Come darkness, come stars, come flame, it would all happen without a by your leave from him. No sense consuming himself in jittery anticipation then. Just relax, sit back, wait, watch it all happen. And then, he told himself, then make sure that you survive whatever turmoil follows.
Going up to the dome? A voice asked.
He blinked in the half-darkness. It was the chubby little graduate student astronomer, Farrow. Was that his name? Yes, as a matter of fact, Theramin said, though in truth he had no particular destination in mind.
So am I. Come on, I'll take you there.
A spiral metal staircase wound upward into the high vaulted top story of the huge building. Farrow went chugging up the stairs in a thudding short-legged gait, and Theramin loped along behind him. He had been in the observatory dome once before, years ago, when Binet wanted to show him something, but he remembered very little about the place. Farrow pulled back a heavy sliding door and they went in.
Come for a close look at the stars? Sephara asked.
The tall archaeologist was standing just inside the doorway, watching the astronomers at their work. Theramin reddened. Sephara wasn't what he wanted to run into just now. Too late, he recalled that this was where Binet had said she had gone. Despite the ambiguous smile she had seemed to cast his way at the moment of the eclipse's beginning, he still feared the sting of her scorn for him, her anger over what she saw as his betrayal of the observatory group. But she showed no sign now of hard feelings. Perhaps, now that the world was plunging headlong into the cave of darkness, she felt that anything that had happened before the eclipse was irrelevant, that the coming catastrophe canceled out all errors, all quarrels, all sins.
Quite a place, Theramin said.
Isn't it amazing? Not that I really know much of what's going on here. They've got the big solar scope trained on Dovim. It's really a camera more than it is a spyglass, they told me. You can't just squint through it and see the heavens. And then these smaller telescopes are focused deeper out, watching for some sign that the stars are appearing.
Have they spotted them yet?
Not so far as anyone's told me, Severa said. Theramin nodded. He looked around. This was the heart of the observatory, the room where the actual scanning of the skies took place. It was the darkest room he had ever been in. Not truly dark, of course. There were bronze sconces arrayed in a double row around the curving wall, but the glow that came from the lamps they held was faint and perfunctory. In the dimness, he saw a great metal tube going upward and disappearing through an open panel in the roof of the building. He was able to glimpse the sky through the panel also. It had a terrifying, dense purple hue now. The diminishing orb of Dovim was still visible, but the little sun seemed to have retreated to an enormous distance. "How strange it all looks," he murmured. "The sky has a texture I've never seen before. It's thick. It's like some sort of blanket, almost. A blanket that will smother us all." "Frightened?" he asked. "Of course. Aren't you?" "Yes and no," Theremin said. "I mean, I'm not trying to sound particularly heroic, believe me, but I'm not nearly as edgy as I was an hour or two ago. Numb more than anything. I think I know what you mean. Aethor says there's already been some rioting in the city." "It's only the beginning," Sephira replied. "Theremin, I can't get those ashes out of my mind, the ashes of the Hill of Thombo, those big blocks of stone, the foundations of the Cyclopean city, and ashes everywhere at their base.
With older ashes below, down and down and down."
"Yes," she said. He realized that she had moved a little closer to him. He realized also that the animosity she had felt toward him over the past few months seemed to be completely gone. And could it be? She appeared to be responding to some ghost of the attraction that he had once had for her. He knew the symptoms. He was much too experienced a man not to know them. "Fine," Theremin thought. "The world is coming to an end, and now suddenly Sephira is finally willing to put aside her Ice Queen costume." A weird, gawky figure, immensely tall, came slithering by them in a clumsy, jerky way. He offered them a giggly greeting.
"No sign of the stars yet," he said.
It was Emot, the other young graduate student.
"Maybe we won't get to see them at all. It'll all turn out to be a fizzle, like the experiment Faro and I rigged up in that dark building."
"Plenty of Dovim still visible," Theremin pointed out. "We're nowhere near total darkness."
"You sound almost eager for it," said Sephira.
He turned to her. "I'd like to get the waiting over with."
"Hey," someone yelled. "My computer's down."
"The lights," came another voice.
"What's happening?" Sephira asked.
"Power failure," Theremin said. "Just as Sheeran predicted. The generating station must be in trouble. The first wave of madmen running amok in the city."
Indeed, the dim lights in the sconces appeared to be on the verge of going out. First, they grew very much brighter, as if a quick final surge of power had gone rushing through them. Then they dimmed. Then they brightened again, but not as much as a moment before, and then they dropped to just a fraction of their normal light output. Theremin felt Sephira's hand gripping his forearm tightly.
"They're out," someone said. "And so are the computers. Cut in the backup power, somebody. Hey, backup power. Fast, the solar scope isn't tracking. The camera shutter won't work."
Theremin said, "Why didn't they prepare for something like this?" But apparently they had. There came a thrumming from somewhere in the depths of the building, and then the screens of the computers scattered around the room winked back to life. The lamps in their sconces did not, though. Evidently they were on another circuit, and the emergency generator in the basement would not restore them to functioning. The observatory was practically in full darkness. Sephira's hand still rested on Theremin's wrist. He debated slipping a comforting arm around her shoulders. Then Aethor's voice could be heard.
"All right, give me a hand here. We'll be okay in a minute."
"What's he got?" Theremin asked.
"Aethor's brought out the lights," came the voice of Emot.
Theremin turned to stare. It wasn't easy to see anything in such a low light level, but in another moment his eyes grew somewhat accustomed to it. There were half a dozen foot-long, inch-thick rods cradled in Aethor's arms. He glared over them at the staff members.
"Pharaoh! Emot! Come here and help me!"
The young men trotted to the observatory director's side and took the rods from him. One by one, Emot held them up, while Pharaoh, in utter silence, scraped a large, clumsy match into spluttering life with the air of one performing the most sacred rite of a religious ritual. As he touched the flame to the upper end of each of the rods, a little blaze hesitated a moment, playing futilely about the tip, until a sudden crackling flare cast Aethor's lined face into yellow highlights. A spontaneous cheer ran through the great room. The rod was tipped by 6 inches of wavering flame.
"Fire?" Theremin wondered. "In here? Why not use godlights or something?"
"We discussed it," said Sephira, "but godlights are too faint. They're all right for a small bedroom, just a little cozy presence to get you through the sleeping period, but for a place this size..." And downstairs are they lighting torches there, too?
I think so.
Theremin shook his head. No wonder the city's going to burn this evening. If even you people are resorting to something as primitive as fire to hold back the darkness. The light was dim, dimmer even than the most tenuous sunlight. The flames reeled crazily, giving birth to drunken, swaying shadows. The torches smoked devilishly and smelled like a bad day in the kitchen, but they emitted yellow light. There was something joyous about yellow light, Theremin thought, especially after nearly 4 hours of somber, dwindling dovim. Sephira warmed her hands at the nearest, regardless of the soot that gathered upon them in a fine gray powder, and muttered ecstatically to herself, "Beautiful! Beautiful! I never realized before what a wonderful color yellow is." But Theremin continued to regard the torches suspiciously. He wrinkled his nose at the rancid odor and said, "What are those things made of?"
"Wood," she replied.
"Oh, no, they're not. They aren't burning. The top inch is charred and the flame just keeps shooting up out of nothing."
"That's the beauty of it. This is a really efficient artificial light mechanism. We made a few hundred of them, but most went to the sanctuary, of course. You see?"
She turned and dusted off her blackened hands. "You take the pithy core of coarse water reeds, dry them thoroughly, and soak them in animal grease. Then you set fire to it, and the grease burns little by little. These torches will burn for almost half an hour without stopping. Ingenious, isn't it?"
"Wonderful," Theremin said dourly. "Very modern. Very impressive."
But he couldn't remain in this room any longer. The same restlessness that had led him to come up here now afflicted him again. The reek of the torches was bad enough, but also there was the cold blast of air coming in through the open panel in the dome, a harsh wintry flow, the icy finger of night. He shivered. He wished that he and Sheeran and Bine hadn't finished off that whole bottle of miserable wine so quickly. "I'm going to go back below," he said to Sephira. "There's nothing to see here if you aren't an astronomer."
"All right, I'll go with you."
In the flickering yellow light, he saw a smile appear on her face, unmistakable this time, unambiguous.